You know, and I'm sorry, who was it? Where is the Honourable Esther Hoyson?
He just stepped up from
the... Yes, I saw him. Yeah, no, yeah. He's broken his glasses or something. Is that it? Can't see now. Oh, dear. But there we are. That would be 4, 5, 6. So we could look at the minutes, yes. Anyway, members, the adoption of the agenda, it's a very, very tiny agenda. We had a meeting yesterday in which we had several inputs. Not once was our advocate able to respond to anything, and this would give her the opportunity to just highlight a few things and for our benefit, etc., as to how they could be taken into account, all right? With respect to the adoption of the agenda, let's have someone to propose adoption. Yes, great, Honourable Tirko, seconded by the Honourable Kachalia. I was just indicating, I'm sorry to hear about your glasses, Honourable Esther Hazen. You know, I know what it's like to be without. We've still got the same issues we had yesterday. The Honourable Bayani Medical, the Honourable Mantash, and the Honourable Tlanguini Family Bereavement. The Honourable Williams, though, is very ill this morning. He called me as well, and I hope he's better by tomorrow. Yes, thank you, Honourable Van Skulfe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to move for the adoption of the apologies, but I want to make a point, Chairperson. We've received the info that some of the members are family bereavements. Yes. And we acknowledge that, but I think it's important to note that I've learned late that both the Honourable Mantashe as well as the Honourable Mklangwini lost their mothers.
That's right.
So I think it's something special that we need to make mention of and to convey our condolences on behalf of the committee to those families. So if there's a close family member, I think it's just important to relate it to the committee so that we can pass our condolences also to those families. Thank you, Chief.
I'm glad that that's been formalised. And I think which has been done in the past, a letter from the committee, you know, on things like a spouse, a child, a mother. Are we agreed on that? And I see everyone agreeing. All right. Yes, Honourable Tirko.
Thanks, Chair. I'm seconding the proposal.
Thank you so much. Right. And then we have an attendance quickly. We've got the DDG, Consumer Corporate Regulation Division, Mr. Nyetsi Tenzi, Mr. Sipa Mandla, Director, CCRD, Debt Relief. Where did I say? I saw him, then I didn't see him. Anyway. Mr. Mahotsi, also debt relief. Right, the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Nomsa Machigari, the CEO, and Ms. I don't see Mr. Masharpa here. No. Don't know, we have Mr. Lamkani. Yes, and I also see the National Consumer Tribunal. Right, thank you very much. But just a minute. Yes, Honourable Tirko.
Can it be noted that we leave early as we're attending labour on our...
Yes, we do know that on the Wednesday, ever. It's almost institutionalised because it's a reality. But I thank you for being here early in the morning as well. Okay. It's before we. It's 8:40 on my watch. We have a quick. Let's do the minutes in just 5 minutes, please. Wednesday, the 2nd of September. August, in front of you. Is page one right? I'm under the impression that please check with the Honourable Mantashe, because Parliament lists her as TP and we list her as PT. So I want that checked up on, please. Yes, Honourable Tiako. Yes. Another one just further down, okay? Tell me, do we not have the correct information in committees in your office? No, because we can't. It's every time the names are wrong. A silly thing. Page 2. Page 2. Page 3. Members, whoever is chairing, please will you note the medical apologies, the bereavement apologies, which is compassionate leave, and I've said this before, as well as the party. There's nothing written here, and the committee secretary should advise you accordingly for the register. All right? Can we have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Tiako, seconded by the Honourable Van Salsbeek.
No, sir, I can't propose.
All right.
Sir, I can't propose.
Right, okay. Yes, Honourable Van Salsbeek proposing. Can we have someone to second? Who was there? Honourable, yes, Ter Haven, you were there. You were there. Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Thank you. The 15th September, page 1. Page 1. Yes, we've done the second. Page 2. All right. The 15th of September. That's what my next minutes are here. Yes.
The second was the 2nd August.
We called that.
Oh, the 1st August, even that one.
We may have done that yesterday.
Okay.
Have we? Let me see. No, here we are. We've still got them.
Oh.
1st August, page 1. Page 2. Now, you see, Mr. Medema, these names are wrong repeatedly. Mr. Hermans, but I mean it's one office. Just help each other. One office. Right. Help Mr. Hermans then. Page 1. Page 2. It'll be corrected, Honourable Tiako. Yes, Honourable Van Skalkweg.
Chair, when I look at the agenda, there's an item election of an acting chairperson whilst you were there. I'm not sure if that's correct.
And let me see if the register is signed. Yes, I was there. Mm. All right, members, let's leave these minutes. Perhaps that's why they were turned upside down, because Mr. Hermans knew there was a problem. All right, let's leave those minutes for Mr. Hermans to fix. Friday the 15th of September, page 1. And I gather you did these minutes. Good. Page 2. Page 3. Now, I definitely was there because I see the registers properly filled in. Right. We please have someone to propose adoption. Thank you, Honourable Tiako. Seconded by... We had Alberts here, we had Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Kachalia. Thanks, Honourable MacPherson. Right. That's the first, if you can remind Mr. Hermans to check the parliamentary register for the correct name. Let's move on then to yourself then, Advocate Van der Merwe, you're going to brief us on this, all right? Are we all ready? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. I think if it would be acceptable to members, I would like to take the presentations as they were done yesterday, and I am not going to a number of these of the things that were mentioned. I will take back and consider in relation to the bill, see if we can make provision for certain things and so on. But I'll highlight maybe the major issues. So if I could start with the tribunal's presentation on slide 5, they made a proposal that the process for alerting the tribunal by the NCR in respect of the debt relief application, that there could be a compliance notice process and so on. I think that would be covered in the regulations. We do provide for the minister to make regulations that will allow for the process to happen. But that is perhaps something that the DTI can just confirm for us, because those regulations will have to be ready by the time the bill is in fact passed by both houses. Sorry, on slide 6, they were referring about a role for the NCR in the tribunal. I think NCR would be best placed to talk to that. I know Ms. McPherson was saying that she would not like that. We already have a capacity challenge at the NCR. But I know that we've also discussed that we need to look at that, and if necessary, the NCR needs to have officers that will be dealing specifically with this. But whether that is something for the bill, I'm not sure. I think that is maybe something outside of the bill itself. In page 7 is something that I think can actually be included, and it's a pity Mr. Williams is not here, because it addresses his concern about the affidavit. Members will remember that I made provision for the credit provider to submit an affidavit at the outset of the process, and Mr. Williams was quite concerned that would allow the creditor to stop the process. And in the end, I've indicated that even if I take it out, we will have to have an opportunity for the credit provider to be heard. And what the tribunal was proposing, in fact, I don't think it's necessarily on the slide itself, but it was spoken to when they spoke to the slide, was that there could be a process. I'm sorry, I'm talking about the wrong slide. I'm sorry, I'll come back to that point just now. Let me rather talk to the right slide, slide 7. Because I also thought that was a valid point, where they made a proposal that where the credit regulator, if members would recall, we made provision for the regulator to reject, and then it will be a referral process that applies. But the regulator can also refer for debt review if they feel someone is in fact qualifying for debt review. And the tribunal made the proposal that those also need to be dealt with as if by way of referral. And I think it's a valid point, because it will also amount to rejection. In my mind, it applied automatically, but I think it would be best to make it very clear in the bill that any form of rejection by the regulator of the debt review could result in such a referral, or that the referral would be available. Then on the next two slides is the point that I was talking to. Sorry about that. Slides 8 and 9. the tribunal considers the rule of audi alteram partem, which simply means that both sides need to be heard in any dispute. And that is a principle that we actually have in our constitution as well. I spoke to it last time as well when I spoke about the affidavit. I think it's section 34 that provides access to court, and it provides for a fair hearing. And that fair hearing includes that both sides must be given opportunity. But what the tribunal proposed, and I think that is something that will actually assist us in allowing the credit provider to be heard without stopping the process, is that there is something that in courts we referred to as a rule nisi. So what the court does is it gives an order, and then it gives a period of time for the other party to come and object. So I think that could actually be something that allows the credit provider then to be heard. So we do provide for both sides to be heard. So if we take the affidavit process out, the credit provider must still be notified. So we should be fine constitutionally wise in respect of the credit provider being aware. I have indicated that there's not much that the credit provider can say, because it's going to be a tick box. Is this your income? Is this? So the credit provider's information is more about the accuracy or the veracity, rather, of the information that the consumer provided. I'm also thinking some of the other presentations made me think that there might be a need for the credit provider to actually have to submit the credit agreement, especially so that they could be seen, so that the credit regulator could check for credit life insurance or credit insurance in general. In other words, when the credit regulator notifies the credit provider to request for copies of all agreements and to ask if there is credit life. So credit provider is aware, and in fact, if because he'll be getting information about the income and expenditure, because that's what we've agreed on last time, so he can give that information. We don't have to provide for it in the Act. And if we provide for this further step, then there is an absolute compliance with the requirement that both parties should be heard. So I think that was quite a useful proposal from their side. I just want to see, okay. Slide 11. I would like to just speak with the committee about the issue of accessorial systems versus inquisitorial systems, because I do think that there is maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding about the two systems. Both an accessorial system and an inquisitorial system are formal legal systems which allows lawyers to attend, which have formal procedures, formal evidence rules, etc. So they are both formal court procedures. The only difference is that in an accessorial judicial system, the judge or the presiding officer, the magistrate, does not participate in the proceedings. It is an objective, the person sits as an objective person. That presiding person is not allowed to ask questions other than questions for clarity. So the idea is to have someone that is objective, that does not control the proceedings, that has no say in what evidence is brought or not brought. The only way that this person can control the hearing is to look at if evidence that is being presented clearly is irrelevant, and there could even be an objection to it, but they could also say, but I don't understand what this has to do with the case, and then that evidence could be considered in that way. If a witness is being, I think the word that members might know, being badgered by a person, they could step in and protect the witness. So, but in the end, they then look at things that are before them. Now, the criticism against the adversarial system is that when your two parties are unequal, in the sense that the one has a lawyer and the other one doesn't, then there is no real assistance. But in practice, when I was still appearing in court, the nightmare of any lawyer was to appear against someone who was unrepresented, because the judge would protect them. It was an absolute nightmare to appear against someone presenting themselves. So in our adversarial system, the judges still protected the person that was, in other words, they were allowed to lead evidence that would, for another lawyer, objections, etc. They were allowed to give that thing. So they were given a lot of leeway because the judges accepted they aren't there and that there is an unequal system. So that is the adversarial system. A lot of pros and the one negative, in the sense that there could be this unequal treatment, but then, like I say, my experience in practice is that the unrepresented person is assisted in respect of law. The inquisitorial system has also a lot of pros, but it also has a negative aspect to it. So it is, like I said, it's also a formal system. It also has evidentiary rules. It also allows lawyers. What happens with the inquisitorial system is that the presiding officer, the judge, the magistrate, from the start of the proceedings, plays an active role. The judge will consider the evidence and decide which evidence will be applicable. And that will then be led during the trial. During the trial, the presiding officer, judge, magistrate, can step in and start asking the witness questions to understand what actually happened. So the judge plays a very, very active role. From that description, I think you can already see what the possible negative is. If the judge does not like your dress, you have a problem. And I'm a little bit facetious, but you know, the judge does not agree with the situation that you're in, or whatever, has some personal issue. It's a lot more difficult to protect against bias in that situation, because you as a plaintiff might feel certain evidence is in fact very relevant, but you would be prohibited from actually doing that. I thought of something, but I don't know if members are film fundies. The original films of the girl with the dragon tattoo, I think it was the third installment, where she actually goes into court in Belgium. That is an inquisitorial system. It's a very good example of an inquisitorial system gone wrong, in fact, because the judge there is a little bit biased. So it's a very, very different system, and you can see it from the participation. But otherwise, it is formal. It's an absolute formal process. It's not informal. So that we must just keep that in mind. I also just maybe want to take this opportunity, while I've now explained the difference between adversarial and inquisitorial, just talk about the CCMA as well. And I'm not saying that we must provide for it in the bill, but the issues came up, and I think it's necessary for members to just get your minds around these things and understand. The CCMA does not prohibit lawyers. There must just be consent for lawyers to attend. So a lot of lawyers still attend. Companies still send their legal advisors, so you're still sitting with an unfair situation. So it is not that it is, you know, I think the concerns that we have, we must just be very sure that we don't try a different solution that might make things look on paper to be easy, but in practice, lawyers find loopholes. That is just how it works. I know that when the CCMA just kicked off, it was an accepted practice that if the lawyer is not allowed, the lawyer will sit outside and the person will simply say, I need to just consult on this. I don't know how to deal with this. And then the person would go outside, meet with his or her lawyer for about 20 minutes, go back. And it became so protracted that at times it's just the lawyers invited in any event. So we must just be careful. Getting rid of lawyers is maybe a different process. It's maybe something else that we need to look at and at how to deal with this. Unfortunately, life is such that it does have a purpose for us. I'm very happy about it, but I understand the concern and because we do make things complicated. But like I said, I'm not sure that adversarial, inquisitorial CCMA is necessarily the solution that we are looking for. And because of what I'm saying there, we need to then also look at the broader review process. Because if we include something like this into this bill, it is going to take a lot of consultation. It is not something that we're going to finish by end of this month. There's going to have to be a lot of thinking, because it's not just as straightforward as it sounds on paper. There's more things to this than meets the eye, and I think members will probably start appreciating that because of, I think one member yesterday said to me something that came up. We think it's so straightforward, but when you start thinking about things, you suddenly realize implications around it. And that, unfortunately, is what this kind of thing will trigger. On that same slide, The tribunal also said they should not play the role of investigating or researching the solutions. And I think that probably speaks to the inquisitorial system, because that is part of what the inquisitorial presiding officer would do, would be to be part of this investigation, trying to find the facts. Something else that's not necessarily a negative in most parts of the world where inquisitorial is applied, but for us might be a negative, is that the fact that the tribunal member would have to participate in seeing all this evidence and doing the investigation would automatically stretch the time period for consideration of a matter. So that must also just be kept in mind. But if we proceed with the process as it is, I don't think that there will ever be a reason for the tribunal to take part as an investigator. And in fact, members have suggested that the steps should now be, or the orders should now be stepwise. So this is your first order, this is your second order, and so on. So that would make any investigation really not necessary. On the issue of, on page 13, general comments, they mentioned that perhaps there could be a tax deduction. I'm not sure. I think that automatically happens because it would be something that the credit provider will have to write off as a loss. So I think it would automatically happen. I don't know if, I know that the committee is going to, I think they are going to invite SAIS to come and discuss. And perhaps that could be a question to SAIS is, could there be something in addition for a credit provider whose claims were subject to debt relief? That was the first presentation. So should I first stop there or go on to the next one?
Carry on, because we do have members leaving from other committees.
Thank you. In respect of the Treasury presentation then, on their slides 3 and 4, they're referring to the debt counselling concerns, but I think that was made clear that it could be part of the larger review, and as came out in the DPI presentation, there is a bill that currently is dealing with it with justice, because it does fall under justice. Treasury mentioned that there's international studies dealing with debt extinguishing, and I was wondering if that is not the ones that we already have, the NINA, in New Zealand, Wales, in the UK, perhaps they could let us have it and we could have a look at that and see what, if there is something that can be used, something that we can consider. On the slide 7, they talk about different solutions for different categories, but I think that is exactly where this bill fits in, because we already have liquidation for companies. We already have sequestration for people where there would be benefits, and we already have debt review. This bill now addresses the part where there is no solution. So there are already different solutions, so I think the committee agrees with what Treasury is saying there. It's just that we are actually acting on it. On slide 8, protecting the borrower's asset, I know that is something that members have also mentioned. We don't want the car to be attached or the house to be attached. It's not always possible because that asset probably, there's still money owing on it and so on. I don't know how to protect it. I must be very honest, because also we fall now into the arena of justice. So that is perhaps something that we can also ask justice, what can be done to protect the borrower's assets. I do think that the fact that there is a suspension of the agreement or the other arrangements that can be made should already stop execution. So that in itself should protect. But if the intention is to protect it further than that I don't have an answer to. So in other words, what the bill currently provides for is once the application is made, all executions stop. You can't execute. So all the assets will remain once the application is in until the process is done, either rejected or the orders at the end have played out. For me, that does mean that the assets will be protected, but I don't know if there's an intention for it to be protected more than that. In other words, if the tribunal sees this person is driving a Ferrari, you know, and that would resolve everything. Should the tribunal not rather say, I think your Ferrari should be sold so that we can pay your credit? I mean, it's now an outrageous example, but it's to make that, that point clear. On slide 10, the second bullet point there, I think the agreed principles, that is something that the bill is still busy being developed, and I think that the way the members have interrogated it last time is that we focus and make sure this bill meets the agreed principles, but that is only really a question we can ask at the end. We have discussed last week why it should be an amendment bill and not a standalone bill. And in fact, one of the questions that came up just showed that it is very necessary for this bill to fit into the Credit Act so that it makes takes advantage of the protection of the other measures, the other things that are already in there. And also, I think already, again, the debate between debt extinguishing or the debt relief versus the broader reform, that is something that is has already been discussed, and the committee has already expressed a view on that. In respect of the role of the Minister of Finance, the Governor, in respect of banks and so on, I have proposed yesterday to Margot that perhaps the committee also consider, or that we recommend to the committee, that we also maybe speak to the Reserve Bank to just find out about the impact of these minimum capital that banks have to keep. But I must just point out that suspension of agreements is currently in the Act. So it is a current remedy that is there. There may even be some stats on impact that it already had. But yes, it is something to consider because that is part of the impact of the bill if something is suspended. We will definitely have to consider and make sure that we are satisfied that the impact justifies what we have in the bill. On slide 11, I think now that the 10,000 is maybe seen as too much and then it brought down to 7.5, if members agree, I will bring that down into the bill. Last week, the 10,000, I'll bring down to the 7.5. I think the next point about the no realizable assets, we've already agreed vehicles would be out and that it would be regarded as part of tools of trade if it is a tool of trade. So I think that is done. Considering the person categories, we need to, it is possible to do that, but we'll have to go and see whether the category in SASSA is in fact the category that the committee is targeting. Because for instance, the other example, indigent by municipalities, was where the subcommittee started. I went to look at the definitions of indigent in the different municipalities, and it differed from one municipality to the other. So we can't use that in a national, we can't say indigent for a municipality. The national credit regulator will absolutely die if they have to apply. And also, because they will have to check each municipality, and also our Act will then not have equal measures for equal people, because it will depend where you live, whether you are part of that or not. So at this point in time, what I'm going to do, and I'll show members, we'll see when I will be able to do that, we'll discuss that later in the MANCO. When I present the bill again and with those amendments, what I'm currently going to do is, what I'm thinking is to exclude municipal debts, but maybe add something for the regulator to be able to refer to a municipality, like they can with a debt review and so on. So in other words, if they see part of this debt is municipal debts, to say, but you are clearly indigent, according to what we can see, these debts will be referred to the municipality. I'm not sure if it will work, but that is currently what I'm thinking of doing to at least address that, so that we have it on everything. In respect of the affordability criteria, I did say that I'm not sure that is the right measure. It is something that applies somewhere else. So if members would maybe apply your minds to the maximum 25% of income, I think maybe the regulator and the DDI can also assist us if 25% of income is in fact the correct percentage. If members then say, okay, let's rather do it that way, then that's a quick change to do. The insurance issue on slide 12, I will make very sure that the bill in fact does provide somewhere for an insurance policy. So, in other, like I said before, maybe when they notify the credit provider to ask for these agreements, and maybe even ask to disclose if there is credit card. Because remember, any document that the credit provider is asked to disclose, the same principles of veracity applies to them. So we are concerned about the consumer lying to the credit regulator and misleading the regulator on his or her income or his or her debt. But the credit provider can also keep quiet about life insurance or insurance in general. So if we have this in there that these documents must be submitted, and if there is something falsely submitted, then the credit provider is in that same boat of having committed fraud. So I think it's maybe a good thing to put some obligations on the credit provider to submit things for this application. We'll just have to give it a time to submit, like a deadline to submit. I've already spoken to bringing in a Reserve Bank. In respect of the number of applications, when it comes to this once-off debt relief, there can only be one application because the debt has a cut-off date. You know, we still have to decide on that date, but so the cut-off date, as I understand it, will definitely be before the act, the bill becomes an act. So you can't bring two or three applications, the debt is there. So I think the concern is more in relation to the regulations. But with the regulations, we also need to, it's difficult to be that specific in the clause that deals with the regulations, because what if it is a natural disaster? I know jokingly last week said, you know, if the minister comes with a request for people who drive BMWs, but if I look at the photographs from Joburg, I think people drive BMWs need something now. It is just BMWs being smashed. It is, you know, it really looks terrible. But the point that I'm trying to make is that it would be debt up until that date of the disaster, you know, or debt may be incurred immediately after the disaster to tow your BMW out or something like that. So that type of regulation will also have a once application. There won't be more than one natural disaster that qualifies under that. The only regulation that the minister can make that might have more than one application is the one where we provide for an informal liquidation process. So in other words, similar to the once-off, but a proper NINA like they have in Australia, in New Zealand, Wales, and the UK. But then I must also say, surely that those kind of things will be considered in those regulations. If we look at sequestration, it's very seldom that someone is sequestrated twice, but it's not impossible. But it will probably happen over a long period of time because your rehabilitation is 10 years. So you can only start incurring debt again after 10 years, and then of course you have to build up, and hopefully the person has learned their lesson in those 10 years and learned how to budget, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, there was once, I think before that, the Companies Act and the Close Corporations Act, in fact, people were having businesses in their own names, and if that business went under, they went under, and then they applied for sequestration. Then if they get themselves up on their feet again, they would make that payment, and they would do a rehabilitation earlier than the 10 years, then they would start another business. If their business goes belly up, they would apply for sequestration. So I'm not sure why this category should be limited to one application only if it is that informal liquidation process. Surely it should be the same as the sequestration. But those questions, I'm just saying, should rather come when the minister considers the regulation. And that will be a risk that will be looked at that stage. And they can do comparisons and come and explain. And like I said, this committee will have to consider in any length, and can they make those proposals. I've already spoken about municipalities. Then I'll go to the regulator, and I think this one is quite quick. One thing that I would like for the regulator to maybe assist me with, but I can speak with them outside of this meeting, they were saying the missing group. And they were talking about people who don't qualify for debt review, but that is what the committee has. We are now reducing it to income of 7.5. And then they said consumers who have, sorry, I'm on slide 4 of the presentation, consumers who have qualified for debt review but do not solve. In other words, they don't become solvent, so they remain insolvent. I think that came under discussion, whether someone under debt review should be able to apply for debt relief. And I think the end decision was no, we feel that it's a gap. And if you already qualify, we don't want to take you out of that system. But perhaps we need to understand, how does debt review stop? How do you get out of debt review if you don't become solvent? So in other words, you remain in a situation where your debts are more than your income. How do you get out of that situation? And if there is no provision for that, that is something that needs to be looked at, because the people who then need to come out of debt review should then qualify for the debt relief. I'm not sure, I'm talking a little bit in a circle there, but it is something that I'm thinking about, and I'll maybe also find out from the credit regulator what the current process is, so that we can make sure that we catch those people. They talk about the once off and so on, and I think that I've already discussed now with the minister and the regulations that the minister can do. Some of the other things in the presentation dealt with things that are currently in the Act, so they should be part of the bigger review. I want to maybe just quickly speak to the because it also deals with the DTI's presentation about the issue of prescription. And I actually want to read the current provision to members. In the Act, it is section 126B, and it says there that no person may sell a debt under a credit agreement to which this Act applies that has been extinguished by prescription under the Prescription Act. Now, the problem is it doesn't apply automatically, the Prescription Act. Eh? So then we say B, no person may continue the collection of or reactivate a debt if that debt has been extinguished by a prescription and the consumer raises the defense or would reasonably have raised that defense if they were aware of it. So this section already says that if the debt has become prescribed when you look at the Prescription Act, in other words, the 3 years, the 7 years, the 30 years, then a credit provider is no longer allowed to execute on that, to continue collection, in fact, or to reactivate that debt. They're not allowed to phone and interrupt prescription. It's done. So the issue for me, I think, is and I know that it should be part of the bigger review anyway, but I thought just to mention it because it came up in both presentations. For me, the concern here is more that there should be awareness. People should be aware that they can claim and say that, you know, this claim has prescribed, you are no longer allowed to bother me with this. I think the proposal made initially was that it should be made an offence, and I think the same with reckless lending, that it should be made an offence. And I think that is perhaps where the Act falls short. In respect of in duplum, I actually really, the credit regulator on slide 8...
Allow me to interrupt you for a minute. The two members that you see leaving are actually attending the Labour Committee, who are extremely short. As you know, their chairperson has become the ambassador of Jamaica, I think it is. Am I right, Jamaica?
Or Jamaica.
No, that's not really very collegiate of you. No. Let us leave that one. Right, thank you. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Jean. Yes, we actually have a bill in that committee, so I'm very glad they're going to quorate.
Yeah.
Okay, on the in duplum rule, the credit regulator proposed that they must actually speak with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, and I would definitely support that proposal from their side, especially as it seems that the biggest problem is attorneys who fall under justice, to see how these things are done. I just want to do one correction. I indicated that there's a declaratory order on the issue. I spoke with the regulator again. There's an application for a declaratory order in respect of in duplum, so it hasn't been delivered yet, but the declaration would ask for the court to declare that your collection fees include attorney's fees and so on. Because clearly that is how the Act reads. But I also think that a discussion with justice could maybe solve that issue, because the attorneys, the Law Society, could issue a directive and say, but this is how this Act is interpreted, and you attorneys need to comply. So I think a discussion with justice could be of assistance.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Could be of assistance there. Then power to suspend, again, part of the bigger review. Then if I go to the trade presentation, also very short, on slide 4, I just want to start with the other debt relief that was mentioned. We need to just keep in mind, what we've got in the bill currently is that unlawful transactions will be excluded, reckless lending, credit agreements that constitute reckless lending will be excluded. So in other words, those debt relief measures are already provided for in the Act. If they form part of debt relief, they need to be excluded, because you can't provide debt relief on something that's illegal. You know, debt relief, we are going to extinguish a debt that is validly, legally due. And because of that, there's a lot of restrictions on this bill, because we're affecting someone's property. To include reckless lending and unlawful lending in that debt relief measure itself, it's very contradictory in terms, because it's already unlawful. It should simply be excluded. So provision is made in the bill that if part of the application contains reckless lending or unlawful transactions, then those will be referred to the tribunal as part of the application. Those will not ever be declared reckless. It will be the end of that. And the rest of the debt, the legal debt, will be considered for debt relief. I've already spoken about prescribed debt. Like I said, I think it's about awareness now. We need to raise awareness. And perhaps part of the bigger review could be to make it an offence as well. On slide 6, I have spoken to the inquisitorial and the adversarial, and the fact that both are still formal processes. Mm. Lawyers are allowed. It's just a chairperson that plays a different role. The concern of the DTI regarding the consumer tribunal's processes, I think it's something that the committee must take into account. But to make, it is something that needs to be reviewed. I think, like Mr. Spap said, in I can't remember if it was yesterday, that a review of the Act, we all acknowledge, is necessary. We understand that. The concern that I have is this... these processes of the tribunal are going to hamper the debt relief process, then the question comes up, one, is the tribunal the correct body? I don't know who else can do it, because if you go to a magistrate's court, we take it out of the purview of trade, and it becomes a justice issue, and I don't know what the backlogs look like there. So we might sit with the same problem, is what I mean. You also have the problem that you then take it into a full court system. So that I'm not sure that is what the committee wants. So I'm not sure who else in the tribunal can do this. But perhaps it is then very urgent for the DTI to at least look at the powers of the tribunal and the regulator in their review, and see if the process on those two things can't be shortened, and that a bill can be brought on that from the executive. So at least that already starts addressing something. The concern is, because the question then comes, okay, but why don't we bring it into this bill? It can be brought into this bill, but there's a lot of consultation that still has to happen on that. There's a lot of considerations, because we will be changing how these two bodies function. Changing their nature, which requires a lot of consultation, a lot of consideration to make sure that they are established correctly. Perhaps also what can be done, but not as part of the bill process, but for this committee themselves to start understanding what is required, is I know justice is coming. I don't know if that is necessarily the correct time, because we are a bit short of time. But maybe justice can also explain to this committee what is required when a tribunal or a body like the CCMA is established in an act? What needs to be looked at? What are the considerations? When you change the functions of a judicial or a quasi-judicial body, what are the things that must be looked at? What are the pitfalls that you need to avoid? So that the committee can already start understanding, because I think that part of the review process then becomes quite urgent. On slide 7, looking at the orders and the fact that some amounts are restructuring, yes, that is so. And the reason for that is that we want to first make sure that the current provisions of the Act, the current remedies provided, are exhausted. In other words, are not applicable. And if we are sure that they're not applicable, then we will move to debt review. And the second point talks to total extinguishing of credit obligations and so on. But at this point in time, the committee has decided that they want this step approach in the orders, where we will first suspend and then extinguish. On the next slide, 8, I think the issue of in duplum I've already discussed. And then 103 is the same. It deals with in duplum. I've discussed that. And that is that on all the presentations. Thank you.
Yes, look, Advocate van der Merwe, I think, the members here in the listening should be no reflection on the commitment of the committee for this. It's just that, as you know, we are very stretched in Parliament at the moment with a series of bereavements, medical leaves, you know, and that kind of thing. But the folks that are here, the members, I know, will benefit from this. Myself. The members, all that it was there was the advocate commenting on what we received yesterday. And I'm not going to, there are so few of us here, so, you know, you can go on for 5 minutes. You know, what I'm saying is, time is on your side at this meeting. We've got another hour, so please, we'll have two rounds, put it that way. Get a response after the first round and then come back. Did you want to comment, Dean? Honourable MacPherson? Honourable Eersterhuizen?
So if there's 3 members, we get 20 minutes each.
Not quite. But no, it's a good shot. Okay.
Thanks, Advocate, for those clarities. With your explanation of the adversarial system versus the inquisitorial system, I mean, my personal feeling is that it still opens itself up to being a long, drawn-out process instead of being able to deal with these, you know, these things on the papers, as we've liked to say previously. And it's also based on the idea that you know, that the person who's dealing with it is going to be fair, which I'm not 100% convinced of with one single member being allocated to do so, which is why I previously said I think that it should be either 2 or 3. But with that system, I mean, you referred to both instances of a judge. Now the NCT is not a court, so they're not judges. They are legally, qualified or legally qualified people to listen to these things, but they're not judges. So I'm still unclear of when someone comes with a referral from the NCR to the NCT, how this thing actually plays out. And then the credit provider comes with a lawyer. I think I would really sort of like a almost like a timeline of what would happen, what you would envisage that case looking like, and how would it actually be adjudicated. With respect to the classification of indigency, and sort of what that number would be, you know, I'm still concerned that we're missing an opportunity by including an amount of 7,500 rand, and rather trying to lower that to say 5,000 rand, and see if we can, you know, rather push people to debt review. I think, and my preference is that we want to introduce people into debt review, so we can keep them in the system, we can rehabilitate them, instead of, you know, debt relief being the first and easiest option, because it actually locks them out for 5 years. Or potentially that could be the longest time that they're actually locked out from accessing credit again. And I think that our first preference should be pushing them to debt review, assisting them to recover, and then allowing them to, you know, be responsible credit consumers again, because we know that the statistics from debt review and those people that follow the debt review process, it has an exceptionally high you know, success rate, and I think that that's what we want to look at. However, if we did do that, if we lowered it, the question becomes, well, who funds that gap of between 5,000 and 7,500 to make it financially viable for debt review organisations? Yeah, so that's me for now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Honourable Yusuf.
Thank you, Chair. Only three members here, and one myself is like dead in the water today. My glasses, I can't read a thing. But I just want to actually, we've been with this for quite some time, where Professor Moseko, the advocate from America, Treasury, and various people for some time, Advocate from America just said that the other side should also be heard. For me, that's very important. The aim of this everything here is to create a consumer friendly credit control and for people that was maybe previously disadvantaged, or for everyone. But I also want to say that we must protect the lender side. This is very crucial, that the financial institution of this country could fall flat, could make it much more difficult, and I've actually said it before. But I think we must come to some conclusion on this. Here at the other side, and even maybe public participation as well. People get more, and then very big concern of me was mentioned by Donald McPherson yesterday as well, is that people are being forced, because there's already laws in existence, there's already laws that that just must be implemented to banks and financial institutions, but they force people to loan sharks. And there's thousands of them, and they're unscrupulous. They take 98% of people's income and things. And those are the people that need to be stopped. Those are the people that we must get some control of. But we really need to come to some conclusion now and get our ducks in a row now that we can conclude it. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much,
Honourable Yester Hazen. Honourable Kachalia, did you want to comment or whatever? Let's have those responses. But before you come in, Advocate Bindamura, One of the things that worries me, it's part of what you're saying, Honourable Esterhazen. You know, we've actually got to look at what were the intentions here. What was the intention when we went for a committee bill? And exactly, are we stretching this beyond what we requested? Because if we are, we've got to stop today. We're either going for a committee bill, as we informed the National Assembly and got permission to move on, that was not to actually amend the powers of X and Y and Z. Not at all. It was not to do a comprehensive review. It was actually to target the most vulnerable who found themselves in this area. And we said, who are we talking about here? And that was our major problem at the time. The major problem was the criteria then, the NINA, the kind of NINA, how do we do it? And it was made clear to us from the beginning as well that if we moved beyond that, which is why we went for the committee bill, it's going to take 3 years. So we went for a committee bill and we said, look, we'll do this in 18 months. We believe we can, to a year. Well, if you go back, when was this sent to the House? It was sent to the House last year, mid-year, May or something. Well, it's way over a year now. And all we've done is talk about the same thing repeatedly. In fact, this committee has become a talk shop. You want to talk, come here. So I really think we've got to ask ourselves, what are the key issues in respect of what, in principle, we've agreed to? And what I did like, and I think the committee should start looking at, in view of what the advocate has pointed out, what are the principles the committee as a whole agrees on? Principles. Then, I thought that we already had those principles earlier on in the subcommittee, but we added one more or two. I think we have to go back to that and ask ourselves, is this it? The second thing that worries me, you know, I really don't have anything against lawyers. We all need a job after all. But the issue is this. You know, the more lawyers get involved in something, and this is borne out by experience and record, the longer a process takes. That is why you go for mediation. That is why you go for other forms. Because it is a longer process. And we cannot go down that route. We cannot. We said this at the beginning, and we need to re-emphasize it. The third thing is that many of the things we wanted and we expressed, you remember, to Justice last year, we said, look, we've got this problem, but it's in your area, your mandate. What have they done? They've already done the bill. It's an act. Theirs is already an act. And we're still talking. I have a big problem with that, members. I do want all members of the committee to genuinely believe and feel the impact that I agreed with this, but what we have to aim for is sufficient consensus on the purpose and objectives that we first sent to the National Assembly. And it's an appeal, really. Let's get through this. We've got two other bills on the table. And I would like us now to stop wandering around the bushes if we don't have a compass. We've got a compass. The compass are those terms that were accepted in the National Assembly. Let's go back to that. Let's identify the principles which I see were added to here and there for us to consider. And let's ask you, Advocate, to please respond to Honourable MacPherson. He's made some valid comments here, and I do think so, and as well as yourself, Honourable Esterhazen. Right.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, I think my first response to Ms. McPherson also addresses your concern about lawyers. I do understand that the committee wants everything to happen as fast as possible. We already understand that the credit regulator will have to spend time. They can't just consider an application in an hour. Mm-hmm. We understand that there will have to be time for them to consider. So already we have a delay there that's unavoidable, simply because they have to write a letter, they might have to look for information, etc. So by the time it comes to the consumer tribunal, we want things to go fast. Because of that, I proposed a motion process. If we now also include the issue of an order, and then the credit provider can come back after that to object or whatever, I think that we are already limiting what will happen on the day that the application is heard the first time. I would not want to go into too much detail on process in the bill, mm-hmm. because then we need to consult with the tribunal and they will have to advise us on that. But we do, in fact, I think the presentation that said there might be one or two changes to their rules, but otherwise they can already proceed with this. So I think what we've currently got, and they can maybe just also check for us if we do the approach where there will be an order and then the credit provider can come back, whether they already have something like that or if we just need to make a little tweak. So on the timeline, I think, I can't remember what I said last time, so I don't want to contradict myself now, but I kind of, in my mind, thought about a 1 to 2 week process in the regulator. Probably closer to 2 weeks because they have to consult people. Then the referral to the tribunal, I don't see that taking longer than 2 or 3 days because I don't know the numbers exactly, but I think it is necessary that, and this perhaps is something that will have to happen outside of the bill, but from a political perspective, oversight perspective, for the minister to make sure that there are dedicated people that will deal with debt relief. These applications aren't going to last for a year. They're going to be 3, 4 months, 5 months, and then they should be done, surely. By then we want the measure to have been done. I don't know how long people will take. There's not a closing date on applications, but I mean there's a closing date on debt. So let's even stretch it. Let's say 6 months. So a dedicated person for 6 months, I don't think that's very unfair to ask. So if that then, if I can, yeah, okay.
I've also wanted to come in there, but let me allow you, Honourable Mike, first.
Sorry, Advocate, I'm really sorry to interrupt you. What I'd actually like, and maybe I wasn't clear, let's say I'm Dean McPherson, I've gone to the NCR, I've put in an application for debt relief. What then happens from at that point? Do I then go to the NCT myself? Does the NCR send those papers over? Do I then go and sit before a panel of people? That's what I'd like to sort of understand. What am I as the applicant, responsible for from once that application has been referred, and how does that process work? And what are my responsibilities then in that particular hearing?
I must say, I certainly would go with that, but Honourable Yesterhuizen?
Chair, thank you. Just one other thing. You also said that this was to look after the poor and thing, and it's true. There's a worldwide trend that the poor subsidize the rich, which is actually nonsense. But we can't be selective in this as well. Even companies that need debt relief and debt counseling must be looked at. Advocate Vanamerva mentioned municipalities and things. I sit on another committee where say it here, where municipalities owes more than 11 billion rand, you know, which is, and what happens to the Dublin rules? Just to mention that you mentioned in this now, where double the amount, where it's three or four times the amount. Where does that come in there, which is part of our legislation, law in this country?
Yes, where I wanted to just add to, I think, a little of what you had said, Honourable MacPherson, and I hope I'm not distorting the point you made. I was thinking more of some sort of flow chart.
Mm.
Now, you know, we agreed in principle in this committee we'd have a tick box approach, in inverted commas, where if you do this, that'll be the fastest. You fill in this form. If you lie on that form, you may be given this, but if you lie, you have committed a criminal offence immediately. We don't even need to say that, but some members felt we ought to be specific in the bill and say that is X. Because anyone who lies on a form, it's already, isn't it, fraud? You see, so it is a criminal offence. So I thought we'd have this. Then I was alarmed when you said it would take an hour to look at the tick boxes. No, I'm just saying, I know I'm exaggerating. But then you also mentioned the Ferrari at one point. So the point is, on this flow chart, I come in. Here is my application. They'll check quickly. I've got my ID there. I've got this. I've got that. The next thing. That quick check surely can't be more than 5 minutes on that application to see that the ID is there, etc. Now, if every box is ticked, what is the next process? I mean, you know, this is where I'm coming along to in line with Honourable MacPherson. You know, so we're here now, we've got through the first block. And if we didn't get through, up above, sent back for ID. Or we're going on to the next one. So from that moment to when I actually get the debt relief, in inverted commas, what are we talking about? How many hours? How many processes? Thanks, Advocate.
Chair, I don't think it can take an hour. I really think it will take at least a week to 2 weeks in the regulator. So what would happen? And I don't have very specific steps because I have not thought of it in depth. And in fact, I would like that to be in regulations because that's very operational.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how well it would be for us to prescribe to the regulator how to work. But what the bill currently provides for is there will be an application. So the person will qualify. Minister will prescribe forms, etc. So you'll be able to fill out this form. Perhaps the regulator will make those available at the regional offices of the DTI. So a person can go to the regional offices of the DTI, get a form, fill it in, submit whatever the thing is that they would say there. I don't know if there would be capacity at the regional offices for people to do a pre-screening. If so, a quick pre-screening can be done there. And the person, they could say to the person, no, but we need this, we need this, we need that. Then that application will have to come to the office in Pretoria for someone to consider. Because we have said that we are concerned about income, so we are going to speak to Labour to find out if there's a way that we can confirm with them what someone's income is. I'm not sure that necessarily that will be quick. I know that when I was still working at DTI, we had an arrangement with SASH where we could very, very quickly check a tax certificate and whether a person actually is up to date with their taxes, because we couldn't buy out an incentive unless the person's taxes were up to date. And I know that by the time that I left DTI and came to Parliament, that was such a quick process. You could determine that online. You didn't even have to contact SASH. There was a central place that you could link into and you get the information within minutes. I don't know if that is in existence with Labour, if there is something where you can immediately check.
Mm-hmm.
But they will have to write a letter. I suppose it's going to be a standard format letter. But you will have to fill in on the letter the person's income, the person's expenditure, the person's debt. They might have to be looking up for a credit provider's address, and we're going to into quite detail now. So I'm not thinking, I don't know, that the regulator might say, no, we can do it in a day, but I don't want to push that far. So it will be for the regulator to indicate to us how long these things they think would take based on their current experience on things that they are looking at. So the person has now submitted at the regional, it has gone to DCI. Hopefully that can be scanned, so it can be an email process, but it's there within minutes. So it can still be at the same day. Then they need to acknowledge, they need to write a letter. That letter, I don't know what would be the best way for that letter. The committee has kind of indicated that we don't want it published in the Gazette. We don't want the whole world to know that this person has applied. But the person needs a letter. So that letter needs to be posted. I'm not going to say anything about our postal system. Let's say the person gets that letter within 3 days. So at least that person within 3 days can stop creditors from banging on their door, because they can say that you are not allowed to, I've applied, so you can no longer proceed with collections, etc., etc., etc. But in those 3 days, of course, the regulator can proceed to follow up on information. If there's sufficient capacity, I don't see why it can't be done in less days, but I don't want to put that's not for me to answer. So this would be, the credit regulator will then have to check the information that's given. So the credit regulator will check income, will check, do the letters. I can't imagine what else they will have to check. I mean, it's on paper. Then that will be referred to the tribunal. That application form will be referred to the tribunal. The tribunal, the commissioner, allocated to a tribunal member. And maybe just here, I used the word judge, but I also said presiding person, judge, magistrate. So it does apply to all type of tribunals, courts, and so on. The tribunal member can look at that application. I suspect a tribunal member might receive 50. Sit in his office, go through the applications, say this is the order. Then those orders will have to be somehow served. I don't know what the process is from the tribunal side, whether it is a letter that is sent by registered mail to a credit provider, whatever. The credit provider will then have to be given a period. Now, remember, this is not the bill currently. This is now from their proposal that I'll add into. So that's what I'm saying. I don't see it taking the delay that I can't really answer to is in the regulator, how long it will take for them to verify information. Because that is the only thing that I think might take long. Then 1 to 2 days in the tribunal, I did not foresee any lawyer appearing. I suppose you can't ban them from the building, but I don't see the need for any lawyer to speak to that. So I don't know if in their practices there would be a need for a lawyer to speak, but I don't see there being any need. If they say, no, look, we need to be transparent, we can't just do it in chambers. I have asked the question about whether they can do it in chambers. The response was yes. I don't know if it is necessarily that these specific things, but if they have to do a roll and say we're going to consider these on this day, and then they sit in court and they go through them one by one, I suppose the lawyer can say, well, if you are on this matter, I would like to speak to you on that. But what is the lawyer going to say? I don't know. So I don't see a role for lawyers in here, especially not if we then do that process where it will be on a return date. So on the return date, of course, there will have to be an affidavit filed in the meantime, but from the date of the order, the consumer will have debt relief. Mm-hmm. And all the restrictions, etc., will apply. So in respect of the credit provider and in respect of the consumer. Then let's say within 14 days, the credit provider has to do an affidavit if they want to object, if they want to say that any of the information was incorrect, what. That would then come, and there you would probably have a lawyer. But at this point in time, I'm not sure why, if the consumer wants to be there, I suppose the consumer could be there. In my mind, I just don't see a reason for anyone to be there when this is considered. You know, so I really don't see a reason for there to be lawyers. But this is perhaps something where the tribunal must maybe assist, because I don't know their processes very well. In my mind, I don't see a need for a lawyer. I don't understand why there would be a lawyer. I know that we creep in everywhere, but I don't see the need for anyone there. I see them actually sitting, looking at these applications. It's a tick box issue. If an affidavit comes before them, we could perhaps, in fact, now, sorry, I'm not thinking while I'm speaking, I apologize for that, but we could perhaps even, to make it very clear that we don't really want someone to be making representations, to say that if they can file an affidavit, and if they want to make representations, they must file an application for that. Something like that, you know, so that it's an extra step, make it more difficult for them to actually get to be heard. So that is kind of how I see it. So I don't see it as being a long process. I don't see for lawyers to be required. Can I just maybe also go on to the other question? The issue of the 7.5 and the 5,000, I might be putting the credit regulator into hot water, but I want to make a proposal that members can maybe think about.
Yeah.
That the qualifying consumer is up to an income of 7,500, but anyone who earns between 5,000 and 7,500, we make a special measure in the bill that those applicants, the regulator must first consider whether they would qualify for debt review. Now, it does place an obligation on the regulator that they don't normally have. So I don't know if that will work. But also, the other thing that we need to get an answer to, and the regulator didn't speak to that in their presentation, is they have indicated to me that there was a fund in the past that was used to subsidize debt counseling fees. And I think if we can get some information on what that fund was it a line item in the budget of the DTI, and then, you know, can that not be brought back?
Yeah.
Because if that can, then we can maybe make that dispensation to say 5 to 7.5. They must refer and see if with the subsidy,
yeah,
it can't work. In respect of the rest, companies and municipalities, the bill currently excludes legal persons, simply because I think that there is a liquidation process for companies that are in trouble. Companies don't have to show a benefit; they can simply be liquidated. So there are. It's not a gap; they can get out of trouble. But if members want us to include it, we need to just think about it, and then I can definitely include that. And then I think, as Mrs. Phelps, more what you were saying, in the bill, I've only stuck to the principles that was initially agreed on. So. If I look like I am flapping madly at things, it is because I am sticking madly to those principles. The committee will have to change my instruction before I will be including anything that goes outside of that measure. I'll try. Where something is part of it and I can fix something up, I can try that. But I am really trying to stick to just doing a measure.
Right.
You see, I could see that Honourable McPherson wanted to come back on something, perhaps what you may have said now or anything else, and then I'll look further afield. Yes, Honourable McPherson.
Thank you very much. With respect to debt relief, I'm just trying to understand. So. If someone was granted, credit, they met the affordability assessment. Something changed in that process.
Mm-hmm.
They lost their job or something. They didn't have credit life insurance. Is it not unfair to the credit provider who met all of their obligations at that time and through no fault of their own is now forced to extinguish debt because someone has lost their job or only earns 4,500 rand a month. And I think that for me is the biggest question that I can't wrap my head around. Is credit that was given legally in terms of the NCA, they met their obligations in terms of the law, and they are being penalised for something
beyond their control,
and they then have to extinguish legally provided credit. And that's the legal conundrum that I can't get my mind around. So I totally agree. Reckless credit should absolutely be extinguished. Illegal credit, you know, credit through someone who is not a legal credit provider, should absolutely be extinguished. And that's why I think that, and I go back to my original point that I made, that I think our first opportunity or our first course of action should be always to put someone or assist someone in debt review, because you know their circumstances once again may change over time. We don't know, but I think at some point we're going to have to engage financial institutions, banks, and micro lenders, and you know, clothing retailers, you know, furniture retailers, etc., about how this is going to be funded, because at the end of the day, they're going to have to pay for it through, you know, illegal credit, you know, measure that they've accounted for. I mean, I know that, and it's in their financial statements that they do account for, they do make a provision every financial year for bad debt. Do they see that bad debt, you know, spiraling now? I mean, I'm not sure that, you know, a big financial institution like a bank, they have a lot of exposure to unsecured credit. I mean, I don't know. You know, is something like, you know, you had spoken that there was some fund, or, you know, that it existed to fund debt review. You know, is a fuel levy, but on credit, something, you know, to go along to assist people in that respect. So for me, advocate, that's the big thing that I haven't been able to answer in my mind at the moment. And I mean, hopefully once this goes out for public comment, we'll be able to also address those issues with financial institutions. But Chair, my concern would be is maybe we should try and address that or try and have some discussions now about that issue and not later and cause panic in the financial markets. I mean, that's something that I don't think we want to be accused of being reckless in doing.
Yes, just to reiterate, so we have consulted with the banks and clothing, etc. We did that last year. It's been done. Some of you were not here, either not members of the committee or perhaps deployed by your parties outside the country. We can't repeat the exercise. Do you follow? Otherwise, it means every time we get new members, we'd be repeating things. So we won't repeat that exercise. It has been done. And that's why I asked Mr. Hermans the other day, I want a file made and numbered with everything we've received. Do you follow? So even if you weren't here, you'll have access to it. And the banks did comment on this. They certainly did. And that's why we began to look at and to try to make it clear we're not looking at every client of theirs at all. We're looking at those clients, and I do take your point, Honourable MacPherson, that look here, you know, perhaps these credit providers sometimes do work illegally or don't do things effectively or within FICA, but when they do, should they be penalised? You know, when they actually do. But I don't think it's a question of penalising. That the committee at the time when the decision was taken was not saying let's penalise these credit providers. That is for another process that the DTI will deal with. But rather, our focus is on those who at this present time have been trenched, this, that, or the next thing, and they truly have a serious problem. So even if this was not there, the funds would not be forthcoming, if I could put it that way. So we are looking at that target group, and we need to decide where we are. There is already debt relief. We have a process for that. It's there. We're not looking at that. And I think this has got to be clear in people's minds. And I think I must insist now and on record that Mr. Hermans provides this, because clearly members have not read their documents. We are not dealing with debt relief. The department will do that in due course. We are not. We're dealing with a particular target group. And in that respect, the criteria became very, very important. What should we be looking at here? And I think one of the points that you did make at one point, Honourable MacPherson, is, or either you or perhaps someone else, was the powers that we were giving the minister in this particular committee bill. Yes, I think that's a valid issue. Is that what we want? You know, you look at one minister, may be great, you know, the sort of minister you can trust not to abuse his powers. But remember, it's not our prerogative to appoint ministers at all. So whatever we put in the bill, you must be sure someone without perhaps the same 100% integrity would still be bound by that and would have not even a chance of abusing that power. So that is, I think, a very important issue that we do need to look at. But the target group, I thought that we had ring-fenced this to some degree, although the point made by Honourable Williams yesterday, and I think you agreed with him, Honourable MacPherson, is one moment finance said 10,000 to us, and the very next moment they're coming out with 7,500, you know. And our original figure was, I think, 7,500, was it not, you know. So those are things that we ought to be worried about. But what we're looking at, members, and I do, you know, I'm sorry that it's only three or four of us here, is with this group, this vulnerable group of people that we're looking at, how do we address them speedily? We can't talk about 5 months. We can't talk about even a month. You know, if you apply to get a loan from the bank and you're in that league of banking with a bank, it takes 48 hours. Now tell me, how do they check? You see, etc. You go somewhere else, you want to get something, it doesn't take that long. So why must a measure that is meant to help the most, you know, the vulnerable, actually be taking this length of time? But I did see a problem with one of the processes you perhaps considered or commented on, Advocate, about the emails, or rather the in electronic response. Even today, SARS has that problem, as we know. So does the companies, CIPCO, etc. So I think it would have to be a combination of electronic application and, what would you call it, manual application, you know, that kind of thing. And yes, one does see problems there. But what I think is important is what some members have raised, is there a fund? Is there some fund that we don't know about, you know, or that perhaps isn't high up on the radar screen? The committee has so far made reference to possibilities of the UIF being used, etc. You know, there's that side of it. But I don't know where child-headed households would qualify for the UIF. So one's always got to look at that kind of issue. Where else are you going to get this? Let's take the example you've given, Honourable MacPherson. We'll say a retail shop or anyone there giving someone a loan, you know, to buy a car, buy some furniture. Well, what fund are you going to use there? Because you're saying, who's going to pay for this, all right? I bought a car, second-hand perhaps, at 40 to 50,000. Now I'm on hard times and I'm applying for this. Who's going to refund that company? Okay? That's even more so than the banks. who's going to fund that? And when you go down the scale to you've bought a fridge or something like that, who's going to refund you there? Is a fridge an essential item? We haven't even got there yet. And someone may be able to tell you it isn't. It is not an essential item. A stove is, but not a fridge. So I would like us, I think if we can maybe just for a moment in time, and with your indulgence, Honourable MacPherson, is to ask ourselves about the minister's, the powers we are giving to the minister in the bill so far. Is that acceptable? Because I think that is an important issue. I really do. Should this be in consultation, after consultation? Should it come to the committee? Keeping in mind we want to make sure the process can be swift. Do you follow? Now, when it goes to the company's tribunal, if that is where it's going to go, then it would worry me that it would take so long there. If you are already dealing with other matters, you know, your normal schedule of matters, which you yourself say, right, we've got that. Is this going to be prioritized? Things such as that, I think those are the issues, without going into the details of this. So I would like to turn to members again, please. Are there any questions around the powers of the minister in this bill? I think that's important. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Esterhazen.
Thanks, Chair. I think it goes back to the question of what National Treasury raised yesterday. Is this a once-off? A debt relief measure, or is it an ongoing debt relief measure? Because if it's an ongoing debt relief measure, then it makes sense why you've included those. If it is a once-off debt measure, then they shouldn't be there. My point that I had raised when we had discussed this previously was that I think that the minister, has to, if it is an ongoing matter, which I haven't made my mind up yet whether it should be once or ongoing, but let's say for argument's sake that it is an ongoing measure, is it a once per year measure? Is it once every 2 years, every 3 years, one per parliamentary term? I'm not sure, and an advocate, I need to get your thoughts around that, because if it was a whenever he felt like it, that I'm concerned about, and that I don't think I'm going to be able to support. But if it is a once per term, or then I think that needs to be written in. And I think that it needs to be, as I had previously said, in that order of, sort of the Minister of Finance, et cetera, et cetera. Then bring that to Parliament, put that out for consultation, and then Parliament then authorises that particular debt relief measure. So those are my comments on it.
No, thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Esterhazen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I couldn't agree more with what you said, actually, and I wanted to ask the same question as Honourable MacPherson also. The ministers, we don't want to create a perception out there. We don't want to call it debt forgiveness and create things that everyone wants now, and the minister is going to write it off and think. We don't want to start that perception, so we need to know, this must be very clear, how is this going to happen? What is the minister's powers going to be? How often is this going to happen?
The frequency, yeah.
Thank you.
Do you want to come in there, Honourable Kachalia? No. I think that's it, and I think that applies to everyone sitting here, to get your minds around that one, because no, we're not looking at a comprehensive review. That must be done by the DTI. Yes, Advocate van der Merwe.
Just on the powers of the minister, I think it is something that this committee is still struggling with. Whether they should, because currently there's two measures that we're providing for in this bill.
Yes.
So one is an immediate or once-off measure where the date of death incurred will have a cut-off date. And that's what I'm saying. I don't foresee that being very long for the applications to come in. I think once the bill is done and application starts, last application should be in 6 months later. But the other question is, do we want the minister in certain circumstances to be able to prescribe a debt relief measure? And those circumstances aren't once per year or once per parliamentary term. They are very, very specific. The only one that envisages an ongoing measure is the informal liquidation. In other words, to say we do want the minister to provide a informal sequestration measure that would allow for people where there won't be benefit to creditors to be able to be sequestrated. So that would be the only one where it would go on for quite long. But again, like I say, we could consider there whether that one should perhaps have additional criteria, etc. That could also be done by way of a bill that the minister brings. So the question, and I think we discussed it last time, was whether this committee should give permission when the minister prescribes. And the problem with this committee actually giving permission is that the minister might then as well bring a bill, because it is the same thing. So if the committee decides that we should rather have the minister bring a bill, then we take that clause out and we don't allow for it to be prescribed. But I have not received a clear instruction from the committee whether it should go the one way or the other way. So at the moment, I'm simply providing for criteria, very strict criteria, so that we don't have an issue. So that could still be an instruction to say, no, look, we'd rather have the minister bring a bill, and that bill will then be passed by Parliament on that issue. But the other criteria, the other circumstances, and why they can't be once per year or once per term, is because they are, the one would be if in one sector there is mass retrenchment. So, you know, we can't say once per year or once per term. We don't know when that will happen. Or if there is, in fact, adverse conditions in a sector or region, and then we look at a regional natural disaster. And if we just look at now, the storm in Joburg, and then yesterday I saw the storm in KwaZulu-Natal, and I don't know which one looks worse. Now, I'm not saying that those kind of storms are the kind of trigger for a debt relief measure. I'm just saying that natural disasters don't necessarily come once a year. So it is not that it will be once a year or once a term, that kind of limit. It is linked to events. So if that is a concern, then perhaps we should go back to say, then perhaps it should rather not be prescribed. The minister should rather bring a bill at that point. Because currently we are providing, and these circumstances comes from the subcommittee's discussions. So the circumstances are there must be an exogenous shock that caused widespread job losses, or a regional natural disaster, or similar event that is of grave public interest. And then in respect of the indigent and child-headed household, it would be something similar to this, but in respect of the ongoing process where there would be an informal liquidation. So, but like I say, those, they aren't periods, and it's for the committee to decide whether that should in fact be included or not.
Well, I think at this point, because we can't take decisions per se with just four of us, these are issues we're going to take to the next committee. I'm just looking here, but I have seen your hand, Honourable Macpherson. I'm just looking here, what is it, Wednesday? Thursday, the NDP, etc., etc., and first, right, I think we said we would give you some space for this, but we may be in a position to take certain decisions tomorrow that would, in fact, inform or, you know, qualify all your instructions that we've given you, advocate. Yes, Honourable McPherson?
Now, I'm still trying to work out if I have a house in Durban, so I might need debt relief after the storms yesterday. I think that if we are to say that that the minister, you know, if he wants to further, you know, have debt relief, that he should bring you know, a bill to that effect, that wouldn't be any different to how the Minister of Finance, you know, brought a specific bill
mm-hmm.
with respect to the bailout of Eskom.
Yeah.
You know, so that, you know, speaks to a specific issue, or like he's planning to do, you know, with SAA. And if that's the route that we go down, then I think it would make sense then, advocate, that this bill is then a standalone bill actually, and then doesn't reside within the NCO. So I think that's something for us to think about. That, you know, if it is going to be, you know, once off in terms of this bill, then it should be a standalone bill. And if we remove Section 88E from the bill, there's nothing stopping the committee from putting another, you know, once off debt relief bill on, you know, to the House, or the minister bringing his own, you know, specific debt relief bill that speaks to, you know, job losses or, you know, or whatever he may want.
All right. Now, look, because we can't take a decision now, I think I've made that clear, we need more members. We will take this in. I will just simply raise it on Thursday. We haven't scheduled it per se, but it will be two or three issues to raise there. Issues around the minister's powers and just a reiteration of the difference, advantages and disadvantages of a standalone or, you know, linkage. You've done that before for us, advocate, you know, and perhaps members have forgotten, but I mean, it's useful to reiterate that particular issue when the whole committee is here. So we didn't have it scheduled for Thursday at all. We didn't have it scheduled, but in order for you to get some kind of way forward, you may not have to be there, but at least the information you've given us on this, which you have, you've given us information on this before. I think we were on the other side at the time, would need to be here and available to members. Now, members, look, we're not going to get further today. We can't take any, you know, strong positions, but we have conveyed to the advocates so far our views on different things, and I think that does help. But I am going to adjourn the committee, but before I do that, I do want to acknowledge the presence of the Deputy CEO of the National Credit Regulator, Mr. Obed Tongwane, whom I saw earlier on here, and as I say, the members of the companies, not companies, I keep on calling it companies, the Consumer Tribunal, and the Consumer Tribunal, of course, is the Professor and Ms. Morales. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned, and I understand this the committee is going to be used for the Manco at 11, is that not so? I need to go over to my office very quickly to meet with an official, and I'll be back at 11. Meeting adjourned until tomorrow, and we are sitting tomorrow in G26. Is that right? Thank you. Yes, no, you. Thank you. Honestly, I want to ask you, you know, you've got alternatives.